May I just begin by saying it's June. That is not a revelation to any of you, but it brings to my mind a story that I am simply not able to contain without telling. Maybe my favorite June story. So I'm governor, and every year we have my favorite event. It was called the Centenarians Brunch. And as the name might imply, we would invite anyone who had turned 100 years of age or older to come to the governor's residence. And there we would celebrate their lives. Every year, something memorable happens. One year, a man 102 years old. His wife is a mere 99. And they have been married for 77 years. That is exactly the way I responded. Wow. I said, 77 years, that's a long time. He responded in a voice about like this. It is a long time. But we're going to get a divorce. I said, after 77 years, you're going to get a divorce? Why now? Wanted to wait until the kids were dead. So someday I'm going to use that on my own. I'm not sure exactly how. So we are going to dig in today to a very complicated part of the world. And there was a German general who at one point in time coined the phrase, the fog of war. And it is that confusion that occurs in the height of anything complex and tense, when you can't gain a sense of context on what's happening, and even individual facts make less sense because there's no context. In essence, the doctrine of the fog of war is that you need to get to a high enough place that you can begin to lay out what the general referred to as battlefield awareness. Many of you will be familiar with both that doctrine and that principle. So while today it is there's a lot to talk about what's going on in Washington, D.C., I'd like to start talking about some battlefield awareness. Let's get at a high enough place that we can make sense of this and create a construct. Now, I see many of you have a piece of paper on your table. If you're inclined, I'd like to suggest you take that piece of paper and divide it into four squares, and it will help organize our conversation today. Just make a line down the middle and a line in the center, and in the first upper left-hand corner, I'd like to suggest you write the term Google Earth View. I want to get into the big picture. What's driving all of this discussion? I think to understand it, we have to understand why it's happening. Second, in the upper right, I'd like you to put the word value as the North Star. I want to talk about what is certain in the world that we're going to be operating in. Bottom left, just put the words rate limiter. There I want to talk a bit about what is it that is getting in our way to finding what I'll refer to later as a uniquely American solution to all of this. And then lastly, in the bottom right, you can just put the words, so what should I be planning for? And I would like to talk through where we are in this bigger picture today. And maybe lay out four or five things if you are a member of a board or an executive team, which all of you will be in one or the other, that you can begin to lay this up against your own experience. So let's just take a look at Washington and say this is symbolic of the government. And what I'd like you to do is to just go to a higher level. And let's take the Google Earth view of what's happening. I would like to suggest that what's happening in our country is that we are actually at the interchange of a very powerful collision of basic values that we have in this country. Everyone who's in this room got into health care, whether you're a trustee or an executive, because we want to be part of a compassionate society. We want to live in a place where people are cared for when they are sick or injured. And it's that intrinsic motivation, that sense of compassion for human beings that drives us. And could I suggest, I think it is a fundamental part of the American ethos. And if we lose that, we have lost a cornerstone of what makes us special in the world. Now, the second and colliding value, I'm going to refer to as dispassion. Not the lack of compassion, but I want to have you think about the term global economic dispassion. We are confronted by a set of forces that in all of our compassion, we have never had to actually face in the way we are today. And that is, we now have a roughly $20 trillion debt. And people want to be paid. That's just a fundamental rule. I would suggest that it is that collision between our sense of compassion and this sense of economic dispassion that is colliding, that's ultimately driving what we're facing. Now, I want to talk about this because I think it is so fundamental to what's driving a lot of hard things that without this big Google Earth system, we're not seeing the full picture of this problem. And I want to talk a bit about the fact that we are 25 years into a 40-year period of dealing with this collision. Now, let me just make that collision come alive for you a bit. About the year 2000, I was at the time serving as governor, and I began to observe outside the United States some things happening that just seemed counterintuitive to me. One good example was in Argentina. In Argentina, they were rolling back a group of constitutionally protected pension plans. And they were also completely retooling their tax system so as to collect more taxes. Nothing really unusual about that, except what I found counterintuitive is that they were doing it in the middle of a national election. I thought these have to be the most courageous politicians that have ever lived. And I went to Argentina, and I spent a day with then-President Menem, the president of Argentina, and I began to question him, not what they're doing, but why are you doing it now? His response was, let me teach you a little about Argentina. Go back, he said, to the year about 200 years ago, and you'll find out that the most important economic power on the earth at that moment was France. Roll forward 100 years later, and you'll see it had changed. No longer France, it's now the UK. But at that moment in time, there were two countries that were vying to become number two. One, he said, was United States of America. The other, he said, was Argentina. That might surprise you, he said, but it's true. We had large masses of land with natural resources. We had a growing population. We had unique technology that could have allowed us to be a powerful entry into the economic forces of the world. We aspired to be a world economic leader. You know what happened to the United States. Let me tell you what happened to Argentina. We made, he said, three mistakes. The first mistake is that our leaders began to realize that if they wanted to get power, they should give everyone pensions. People really liked that, and it was compassionate. He said if we wanted to keep power, they figured out that you could make it hard to change those pensions, and so people constitutionally protected them. And over a 70 or 80 year period, every regime used the same strategy. And by the time we got into the late 1980s, we had 60% of the entire population of Argentina either working for the government or on a government pension. And he said to me, if you have 40% paying for 60%, that's a problem. Second thing, he said, we didn't have enough money to pay for all of it, so we started to borrow money. And we borrowed it from everyone. We borrowed it from banks. We borrowed it from the World Monetary Fund. We borrowed it from anyone who would loan it to us. We had a pile of debt. And our mistake then, number three, was that when they said to us, you need to change this or we can't continue down this road, we ignored them. And so a few years ago, they came to us and said, if you don't change this, there will be no more money. It was at that point I realized this was not political courage. This was an economic imperative that they had to deal with that matter. Their sense of compassion had collided with a global version of economic dispassion. Many of you may remember the end of the story. President Menem left office, and a new president was elected. He lasted a few months, and there was a second new president, and then a third, and then a fourth, and then a fifth. Five new presidents in the period of less than a year. And finally, it became clear that the proposition of change was so hard that they could not stand up to it. And so they did what most countries do at a moment like that. They printed new money to pay for old debts. And there's an economist somewhere in this room who's going to tell us what happens when you print new money to pay old debts. What is it? They got inflation. 5,000% inflation. And frankly, they have still not recovered. Now, I tell you that story. We sit among the home of the free, the land of the brave. Could that ever happen in the United States of America? I'm not going to ask you, show you a lot of charts today, and you don't have to read that one from the back. I'll just interpret the fact that there are three colors there. The bottom one is Social Security. It starts in 1974 and goes to 2034. The light blue is health programs, and the other is gray. The gray is all other spending. Now, could I suggest that all other spending includes national defense, and it also includes something called interest on our debt. Right now, we have interest rates at a very low rate. Yesterday, we had the second this year interest rate bump by the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve has made it clear that if they raise them to traditional levels, that it will increase the amount of our budget that goes to just interest to $800 billion more a year. It makes that gray line look dramatically different, much smaller. Here's my point. We are in a place where making changes in the way healthcare is beginning to erode everything else is no longer just a function of good economic judgment. It is no longer simply a matter of good management theory. It is no longer something that we can decide as a political measure to do or not to do. This is an economic imperative. And so I go back to that point that we are seeing a collision between our compassion and our dispassion, and we are in a transition. And I suggested to you that I think we are 25 years into a 40-year transition, because I think, to the credit of the United States, whether we have acted it or not, there is a broad awareness that we are in danger of falling into this same trap. and that there are, in fact, consciences that are beginning to be tweaked by this and people who are beginning to worry about it. And almost subconsciously, we realize we cannot allow that blue to continue. So we started many years ago in at least talking about it. Let me lead you back to 1965, which is before this happened. All of you know what happened in 64, 65. We passed the Medicare Act and the Medicaid Act, perhaps among the most profound periods of or manifestations of our human compassion that our country has ever engaged in. We want people to be cared for when they're elderly or in financial need. At that time, we also created a new payment system, what we now know as the fee-for-service system. We clearly began to operate with coding, with medical coding. It became clear that this fee-for-service system, with these medical codes, with one for each, with every CPT code for every procedure, was really not going to work because it would drive costs in a way that were simply unacceptable. They were creating incentives that everyone did better if they just had more, and if somebody else was paying. All of you know this set of incentives. So literally in the late 1970s, a group of professors at Yale, acknowledging this, invented something all of you work with every day, the DRG. They simply took a group of procedure codes, lumped them together into essentially a basket, and said, we're going to start paying people on a basketful as opposed to one at a time. And that might, in fact, begin to create incentives for people to do better at being efficient. 1982, these professors persuaded a group of hospitals in New Jersey to begin using this DRG system. It worked well enough that it spread to New York. And in New York, all the hospitals adopted this bundle full of CPT codes. And that, in my mind, is the point at which we as a country began to say we've got to find a solution to this payment structure that is ultimately going to lead us to a place we can't sustain. So if you just think through then, 1992, we had an election. Bill Clinton started health reform. A big part of it was to find ways to coordinate care better. It didn't pass, but you'll remember the Managed Care Act did. And magically, we started to see healthcare costs even out because we began to manage care more directly, not just letting anyone do whatever they wanted with these CPT codes. The problem was people hated it. They hated it so much that they passed the Patient's Bill of Rights and it reversed it all. And to no one's surprise, healthcare costs started what? Going back up again. We had another election. Actually, before that, we got into the 2003, 2005, 2007 range where we began to have Medicare prescription drug benefit and the early stages of value-based care. Then the election with Obama, the passage of the Affordable Care Act, and accountable care organizations were born. However, at that point in time, the Republican Party began to use the words what? Repeal and replace. And they, for three elections in a row, began to agitate that they wanted to roll this back. They got power. Turns out they didn't know what repeal was, and they didn't know what replace was, and they're struggling. Here's the point I want to make. We'll talk about where they're headed, but we can't think about what's happening in Washington today as simply being a 3 or 4 year cutout. This is a 40-year period, and we are marching along a pathway, all driven by this economic imperative that we have and this sense that if we don't solve this with glacial-like certainty, we will end up in the same place as every other country who has failed to heed that warning. So we're going to talk today about what's happening. You're struggling with it today. We are now undertaking a very difficult transition, and I would suggest to you, we're about 25 years into it, and we've got another 15 years to go. There's nothing magical about that period. But if you look at what's happening in D.C. in that context, that this is yet another iteration on that trail, it makes more sense. It gives you a context in which to see what you are, in fact, operating on. So let's go beyond and just ask this question. So why is it then that if we're going to solve it, we can't just find a solution? Well, I would suggest that we are, in fact, have a conundrum. And here's the dilemma. If we decide that we're going to just go with compassion and not worry about the costs, we're going to lose our economic leadership. If we decide that, in fact, we can't afford compassion, we essentially lose our soul. Both of those are unacceptable. And so we find ourselves in a place now where we're being forced into discovering, into finding what I'll refer to today as a uniquely American healthcare system. Now, I say this because you're trying to plan. And I would suggest to you that this uniquely American healthcare system is not being offered as a proposal by either side. And that, in fact, it's not being offered by anyone. But that in our democratic process, we have a system where over years the sides compete, and ultimately through whatever forces bring them, a new and unique place begins to evolve. It's the way democracies work. This uniquely American system is likely to be the product of a lot of conversation and market forces, not just economic market forces, but the marketplace of ideas will ultimately produce this. So if you stand back and look at the Google Earth view, what have we learned? I think we have to say we've learned, one, that this is being driven by economics, not politics. Two, that this is not a new fight, that it's been going on for at least 25 years and potentially beyond that, and that we are moving toward what can become a solution. It is not going to be produced by the Republicans or the Democrats. It's going to become produced over time by this sense of democracy and the competing ideas. And we're smart if we can sort of look ahead and figure out what that looks like and begin to play into where it's likely to end up. So at the heart of this I've talked about is this idea of fee-for-service payment and the transition to this new kind of payment where we're paying for value. Everyone's still struggling a bit with what value means. I won't get into that unless you want to in our discussion today. But the reality is that's at the heart of this uniquely American system, changing the way we pay for it. Now, we're well into this. And so there are people asking the question, is that going to change? Well, I'd suggest that this is not going to change. The politics are going to be overridden by the economics of that graph. I'd also suggest that we're a long ways into it. Let me just show you a graph. This is the United States in 2010. And this, the darker the spot, the more activity there was in the form of what we now know as accountable care organizations. Anyone here part of an accountable care organization? Okay, most everyone now. 2011, a few more. 2012, even more. 2013, 2014, 2015, 2016. If I had a 2017 slide, it would be even darker and even more. We're moving with some deliberation. There's still a lot of lives that are not being paid out of this new payment system, but we are very clearly moving this way. And it's not simply a matter of people deciding to do it. It's this economic imperative. So the next question I would ask is, what is the rate-limiting factor? Why can't we move faster toward this uniquely American system? Well, I would suggest to you that the big rate limiter is provider readiness. Now, the reality is everyone talks about this. But when you get one or two or three questions into an interrogation about how good people really are at paying for health care through value, it becomes very evident that we're not as good as we need to be, because this is hard. So, all right, I'm a Westerner. This is a cattle drive I took a picture of. Has anybody actually been on a cattle drive before? All right, I'll get some help from a few. So I want to be clear, I'm not comparing people to cows, all right? But there's something very important to be learned here about the process of change. So when it comes the second week of May, we always get our cattle rounded up in the pasture down near town, and then all the cowboys and cowgirls come together to take the cows jointly out to the range. We get behind the cows and we start moving them. We have to make a lot of noise and whistle and do things to get them to move. Why? Well, it's because there's grass there and they just as soon sit there and eat. But there's a problem. If you get these cows moving too fast, there's a lot of noise and dirt and confusion. It's a very noisy place, and the noise just isn't a bunch of cows having fun. It's these cows, the mother cows, trying to find their baby calf, and the calf trying to find their mother cow, because they need to eat. And when they get to the point that they have not nursed for a while, there's something very intuitive inside a mother cow and their calf. And if they can't find each other, they will turn around and go back to the last place where they nursed. And that's called a stampede. Because once they start, they don't stop, and you don't want to be in front of them. So the cowboys and cowgirls have made a discovery. And that is, you do have to move them forward. But at the same time, you have to periodically do what they refer to as mother up. You got to stop, let the cows find their calf, nurse, and then you can move them forward. Well, we're at a place right now in our country, and all of you will acutely be aware of this because you come from organizations that have both a plan and practice and care providing. And tell me, is there a little tension at times about the way people are paid and the speed at which you can go to value? The problem is that those we're expecting to make these changes to provide care under a system where value is what we pay on are having to learn an entirely new system. But I would suggest to you that it is vitally important that the payers in this room realize that if you don't keep that moving forward, it's very easy for the whole system to become intuitively intent on turning around and going back to the place where they started. And so there's this balance of moving forward, but allowing people to mother up for a while and be able to learn these new competencies that's an absolute necessity in being able to make this uniquely American system work. So I'd like now to move down a little closer to Earth and talk a bit about the process we're in right now with the Affordable Care Act, passed in 2010, and transitioning what the Republicans hope will be the American Health Care Act of 2017. Just for perspective, to give us all a common place, let's acknowledge that in 2010, as I said earlier, the Republicans started to campaign on the words repeal and replace. The problem is they didn't have any idea what repeal meant and replace meant. Now, in 2012, I was asked to be the chairman of the transition committee on Mitt Romney and what he hoped would be his administration. And I had a problem because he had also been one of those saying we're going to repeal and replace the law. And it was my job to figure out exactly how that would happen. And it became clear that even at that point, the law had become part of our life for 2 years, and that there was no way you could act as though that had never happened. And so we had to come up with a political strategy on how to deal with it. And our strategy was we would essentially come up with a definition of repeal that was as big as we could get, and one that would be replaced that would be as big as it could get, and no matter what passed, we would just call it repeal and replace. It was really the only strategy available. Now roll forward 6 or 4 more years, and now they take control. They don't have a plan, so what becomes the plan? The same strategy I laid out. They have to come up with a bill that is as much of a change as they can and as much of a replacement as they can, and they'll call that repeal and replace and declare victory. Why? It's because this is part of a 40-year transformation. And this is just one more iteration on that road. And so as we now see what's happened, the House has now passed a bill in the context of Washington politics. In order to get a bill passed, they had to pass it through the House first. And frankly, they had to do whatever they could to get a bill passed, and then get it to the Senate, where they knew the Republicans were in a much different situation. Whereas in the House, they could pass a bill and enforce their majority. In the Senate, they could not. They have a 2-vote majority. Plus, a lot of this is proving not to be particularly popular. So the Senate, as we speak, is taking the bill that Republicans had, in their mind, viewed to be this big, but in the House moved it to be about this big, and they've moved it over to the Senate, and they'll take it from where it is here down to about right here. So if you're worried about the Affordable Care Act being dramatically changed, it's not likely to happen in this process, but it will begin to implement some change. And so in the context of that conversation, let's talk about what those changes might be. First, again, in the context of this long conversation, could I suggest to you that there are 3 or 4 questions that are at the heart of this debate, not just today, but for the entire 40-year period. And we're debating them again now, and we might tweak them a bit now, and we may tweak them in the future. But at the heart of that is one of these questions. Will risk be distributed to ratepayers or taxpayers? In other words, ratepayers being private insurance, taxpayers meaning government-funded programs. Now, the Affordable Care Act moved the needle toward taxpayers quite a ways, expanded Medicaid dramatically, created large subsidies, and at the heart of Republican objection is that they view this differently. They would prefer to see risk spread not on the basis of who pays taxes, but on the basis of who pays rates. And so this debate is continuing. And one of the changes I think we'll see is it is likely that they're going to have in the Senate some form of tax cut, and they will pay for that through some form of reduction in some of the government subsidies that were provided, namely Medicaid. Now, frankly, Medicaid is a very popular program, not just among those who are receiving it, but also in the public. We're a compassionate country. And so we're not likely to see people want to be turned out on the street. Without going through a lot of the numbers we can get through in our discussion, let me just say, I think we're going to end up with about the same amount of money in Medicaid as we had before, maybe just a little less. But the big trade-off is that they're going to allow the states a lot more flexibility, which leads us then to the next question. So what will the role of the government be? Will it be to be the organizer of care, or will it be to be the provider of care? Again, the Affordable Care Act sort of moved us to the left on this one, and the American the American Health Care Act will probably move us a little bit to the right. The third one is which government, state government or federal government? The Obamacare Act moved us to the left. This is actually going to move us to the right, but not this much, but about this much. So I'll just conclude by summarizing. We are part of a very large historic shift. It's roughly 40 years. We're about 25 years into it. At the root of it is the how we pay for care and who pays for it. It's being driven by an economic equation that is glacial in its certainty. We will continue to iterate on this. But finally, could I just say, I think there are five things I would ask you to think about and what you can and should plan for. The first is that this is going to continue. There will be continued iteration. This is, in fact, part of a 40-year transition, and we won't have absolute certainty, not now, not in 2018, not in 2000. And so we're going to have to operate in an atmosphere where there's some ambiguity. Second, that value is, in fact, the North Star. No matter what happens, if you can figure out ways to provide quality care at a low cost, you and your organization will succeed. So through all of these other things, keep your eye on the North Star, and it is value. Third, what's impeding this uniquely American healthcare system to emerge is that providers are not yet ready. And I would suggest that if you're part of a provider organization, work on being ready. If you're part of a payer, which all of you are, the idea is keep the pressure on. But don't forget to mother up, because the stampede could start and make it counterproductive and the outcome won't be good. The fourth is that we are entering a period of what I'll refer to as an era of collaborative IQ. The ability to solve problems collaboratively will pay a great dividend. We have, Kathy, Eddie, and I have a shared interest in this, and I've written a book that I think they're going to kindly give you a copy of, and I'm not promoting it. I'm just telling you that I believe, in fact, that we're entering a period where the ability to lead collaboratively will be the skill set of the future. And as you build teams and as you work to solve problems, and hopefully the book will give you at least a few ideas on how to do that. And lastly, I'm going to leave you with a challenge. What we're talking about here is very serious change. And you really only have three choices in how you deal with that change. The first is you can fight it and die. The second is you can accept it, go along, and have a chance. Or lastly, you can lead it and prosper. And I would argue that what has made the United States the most important nation in the world is that we have taken on difficult problems like this, and we have found a way to lead through them. This is a problem, as you can see from that graph, that has humbled other nations and to an extent brought them to their knees. And the solution will not be found in Congress. It will be found with organizations like yours who can, in fact, innovate and move toward quality at a lower cost. That is the North Star. And I believe that we as a country will solve this and that, in fact, we'll continue to be a great nation as a result of those efforts. Now, I hope that I have been adequately provocative, that I have stirred some of you to rebuttals or questions or even just statements. Who will be the first? Yes.
Wait, Sharon, hang on a second.
Yes, we have a few, I think, who are listening in, so we'll use the microphone.
Very good. So, Governor Lovett, we've talked a little bit earlier about the consumer and the value of the consumer. Where do you see the consumer fitting into this picture? They play an instrumental role.
Well, I think it's very clear that we are living in a world where millennials and every other generation is changing the way they view selection of products and services. And that they are going to play a substantial role just because of the technologies that we use. And that, in fact, we're going to see entire systems now being forced to deal with consumers who have never had to deal with consumers before. And so we're seeing new products, new presentations to say, if you will join our health system, this is how we will manage you. And I will tell you that I'm sure all of you are beginning to feel that. But we're not the first industry to go through this. We were talking earlier. I have a lot of titles, but the title that I value the most is Diamond Medallion. And you know why? I fly a lot, so do you. And I end up in these small regional jets that were not exactly built for my phenotype. But I still take it. And oh, by the way, I have covenanted with Delta Airline that I will fly on their airline every chance I get. I'll stay in their network if they will provide me with special privilege. And we're beginning to see the same thing begin to unfold in healthcare. We're seeing networks that are formed, narrow networks. We're seeing a trade-off in premium, and we're seeing consumers have more information about their satisfaction with that. And it will continue. It's clearly part of this whole movement toward value. Instead of being directed, we're going to choose. And that's one of the competencies that I referred to that providers are having to learn. It is foreign to them. Many of you are in health plans and you work in a competitive environment. You have to help them learn. You've got to keep them moving toward this, at the same time not forgetting to mother up.
Governor, thank you for being with us and for those very interesting remarks. You were one of the early innovators in state-based initiatives on Medicaid redesign. If another progressive governor came to you and said, how should I redesign my Medicaid program, what would you tell them?
Well, that would be a delicious question to begin with. Let me say that I believe Medicaid is perhaps the most important and potentially effective tool to begin to drive change that we have in the whole system. And I will say that because it's being done at the state level, not at the federal level. And I'm of the view, after having spent time running the federal healthcare system, that I was all excited about the fact that I would have my hands on the wheel of the most important healthcare payer in the world. And then I realized there's just a lot of other hands on the wheel. So it's very hard to change the whole country at one time. But with Medicaid, governors and states can innovate. And I have observed that it is viral. Once one does it, others begin to do it. And there are some things that I believe we're going to see happen in Medicaid that would be characteristic of the system that I would suggest if a governor were to ask me. The first is that the federal government and the states have been going through this fascinating discussion about so-called block grants. All of you recognize that term. Well, like the term repeal and replace, no one has actually defined what the word block grant means. To the state, to a governor, the word block grant means leave money on a stump in the woods at night, and we will take care of everything. Completely divorced of anything other than cashing the check. To the federal government really wants some kind of certainty in the way they budget. They want to be able to say, if there's a lot of new people we don't want to have to pay for them, you work it out. Well, when either side figures out what the other's definition is, it's not going to happen. And I've been through this a whole bunch of times, and we're not going to get a so-called block grant, but we are going to see a substantial amount of new flexibility that will go to states. Now, the states are also going to want some certainty. They're going to want to lay off risk, and they're going to go to a managed care Medicaid system. And so that would be my first suggestion. If I were a governor, I would get everything I could into a managed Medicaid plan at a local level. And I would incentivize them to find efficient ways of doing it. Now, obviously, the states do that. They're going to delegate it to all of you, and they're going to want certainty. And so are you. And so you're going to go to providers and start saying to them, I need you to give me some kind of risk contract so that you're bearing this risk. Well, the second thing that's number one. I would get everything as rapidly as I could into a managed care setting. The second thing is I would recognize that, and as I think people are, just health care alone and managing health care isn't enough. A lot of conversation now about the social determinants of health. How much education does a family have available to them? What about their welfare payments? What about their child care? What about their job preparation? What about their transportation? And it's become very clear that these social determinants are, in fact, having a great impact on the health spend. And I predict that we will begin to see managed care providers working with the state to say, you have delegated Medicaid to me. How about you let us work with you on a number of these other services that you are rendering as a state that have a big impact on our spend that we have no control over, and that we're going to see a lot of new care models developed out of Medicaid. That'd be the second. The third is I would begin to look for entirely new ways to change the care model in Medicaid. We cannot simply contract our way out of this. We have to find ways of completely redesigning the way care is delivered. And Medicaid is the place that can happen. So I see it as a grand opportunity for any state, and for that matter, any system, to begin to drive change.
Hi, Governor. I'm Gary Mizell with a health plan, Western Health Advantage in California. So I'm going to ask you a question not as a healthcare expert, but as a political expert. Okay. So the legislation that passed out of the House barely passed. It was, I think, just a handful of votes. As you mentioned, the Senate looks like they've got to move it. The moderates are going to make changes that may make it unpalatable if it goes back to the House and the caucuses. So do you really think that anything is going to happen this year, given that dynamic, given how we're distracted, Congress is distracted with the Russian investigation and this and that. Do you really think something is going to pass Congress and be signed by the president this year? And if it's not, are we done until the next presidential election?
So I'm a bit out there on what I'm going to tell you, but I will say it and I believe it. The Republicans, as I suggested, have dined out for three elections in a row. They created for themselves what I think is a political imperative. They have to deliver something that they can call repeal and replace. They have to. And I know with certainty that Mitch McConnell in the Senate right now is saying to the conservatives in his caucus, now you're kidding me, right? You really want to kill this in a way that there's no way they can get, so we'll just stay with the Affordable Care Act. That's what you want to go home and tell people? I believe they will get a bill, and I think they'll get a bill in the next 2 or 3 weeks in the Senate. Then the real challenge, as you point out, is they're going to go back to the House. The House has this faction known as the Freedom Caucus. Everyone's become quite familiar with them, which is exactly, by the way, what they wanted. I believe they would have done what they did on the Affordable Care Act no matter what the bill was. If they had decided to put the tax cuts up first, the Freedom Caucus would have said, not good enough. You're not getting there without us. They had to demonstrate that they had the capacity to be relevant in the conversation. And they did. So if you're in that situation, all of you have negotiated. You know that if someone behaves that way, you can't stay at the table, can you? So Donald Trump and Paul Ryan walked away and said, okay, there you have it. It's the Affordable Care Act. Good luck. Well, it was just predictable that within 6 to 8 weeks, there would be a news conference And suddenly there would be a vote called and they'd get something through the House. There was a lot of work going on behind with those people to say, let's just get this over. You can't go home without this with something passing. So they accomplished that. They went to the Senate. We're going to see a similar thing happen. It's going to be far closer to the middle than any of those people in the Freedom Caucus ever dreamed of wanting to support. But now they truly have a binary choice. It's either this bill or complete failure and a clear signal to the world that this Republican Congress cannot govern. And so I believe that we will see between now and the 1st of September a bill pass the Senate, and they will go to the House, and I think it may be tweaked a little, but I think it'll pass. I don't think it's going to be a huge change, but I can tell you it'll be called repeal and replace.
Thank you.
John Burge with Passport Health Plan. Governor, I loved your slide on the cattle herding. Unfortunately, I think providers are more like cats, and that's really difficult to.
I don't have a story for them.
And I think changing those behaviors are going to be the behaviors of providers to go along with risk is going to be sort of difficult. But I also agree that consumerism is really important. And I'm an old HHS guy and worked in Utah with you guys for a while. But I also believe that engaging the state, which we're not used to doing, to help us work with them on addressing those social determinants. Someone's in Medicaid, they're in SACWIS, they're in TANF, they're in SNAP, they're in a lot of different things. So I think as a you coaching us is I don't think we're used to playing the game of working with the state and the state governor shaping policy for them. If I asked the state today, would you allow me to have access to foster care data? They would say no. If I would ask them, would you allow me for vital statistic data? Am I giving wheelchairs to dead people? No. So, we need some coaching on, and I agree Medicaid is transformative, but we have to work together, the state.
So we have governors in states that 31 of which are Republican and the rest are Democrat. Maybe there's an independent in there, I can't remember. It generally has not been the state that has been the inhibitor of innovation and change in Medicaid. It's been the federal government. States will endlessly go to the federal government with ideas. The federal government has simply said, no, as your partner, we're not going to allow you to do that. The big change in the environment that I'm signaling you right now is I believe that the action is going to move to the state and that the federal government is going to become dramatically more flexible, at least for the next 3 years. And that's not being done just out of a sense of their belief in federalism. It's because some of these issues are so hard, they would like to punt it to the state who will do things that the federal government won't. So I'm suggesting to you that while the big trade-off here is going to be slightly less money for a lot more flexibility, if you've got ideas on how you can begin to incorporate the social determinants in health, if you have ideas in the way you can begin to structure Medicaid differently to provide for high quality care for fewer people, for more people at a lower cost, bring them forward, because I believe one of the major changes that's occurring here is that HHS, once they get their team fully staffed, there's going to be a lot more flexibility, and I think you'll see more flexibility built into the law that ultimately passes. It's part of the core ideology. Now, will it not change again? It'd probably change again once you get a government in place that believes that the federal government ought to be a greater player there.
Mary Ann Turno with Happen Detroit. Thank you for joining us. Governor, from your perspective, can you comment on what you think is the wisdom of our political and regulatory and even so much as public discussion of all these recent years has been on how we're going to pay for healthcare and for whom we're going to pay for healthcare, and has been disproportionately less focused on what healthcare costs?
Well, I think we've learned some things over the last few years. One is going into exchanges where consumers did, in fact, have a chance to choose plan. Most of you were in the exchange, I'm suspecting, and the first thing you learned is that the most important thing to consumers was what? Cost. And With that determination, plans have begun and providers have begun to create means by which goes back to my diamond medallion. They're beginning to covenant with their patients that if they will stay in their system, they will do things for them that they can't afford to do, or they'll do it at a lower cost. I believe cost is going to continue to be a bigger and bigger role, not just because of that, but we're also beginning to see a shift in who's assuming risk, and part of that risk is going where? To the patient. Patients are dealing with higher and higher deductibles. Now, many of your sister organizations and plans are becoming quite alarmed by the amount of new receivables they have because of these high deductibles. I would suggest that is a competency that's on that list of things we all have to learn. Part of the reason that's happening is because we're having these large deductibles, but no one is including a health savings account, which was intended to be the way that could, in fact, could be paid for. So I'm suggesting that we have a lot to learn here, and we wouldn't do this if it were easy. This is hard. We're doing it. Why? Because of global economic dispassionate forces that are thrusting this on us. And the ultimate solution will not be what either party proposes. It's going to be where the market forces of ideas and economics lead it. And if I were in your position, I would advocate with you to begin to create some assumptions about where you think that's going to lead. Spend less time thinking about what's happening today in Washington. Spend more time thinking about this 40 years and where along that path we are and how you can position yourself to be.
Governor Leavitt, this is Brandon Fryer with Presbyterian Health Plan. Thanks for coming here today, and thanks for framing up, I think, the larger context and the two discerning views and conflicts between compassion and the economy. My question is on Medicaid expansion and where you think those Medicaid expansion states, where does the compromise end up in whatever gets ultimately passed, as you have states that are highly dependent on this expansion population with a potential for dramatic reductions in coverage in those states. And being from New Mexico, it's especially painful for us if you were to roll back expansion and what that looks like. So if there's a slight decrease in funding nationally, how does that pair out at a state-by-state level, in particular with respect to those that expanded Medicaid?
So there are two things that I think we can count on being in this bill. One is that the amount of money at the beginning will be about the same, not a lot more, maybe just a little less, and that the grand trade-off will be that we'll give more flexibility. But the third component is that they are going to say, let's phase this expansion out. Are you hearing that? Senate bill right now is saying let's phase it out over 5 to 7 years. I predict it'll end up being longer than that in the final analysis. And I'll just tell you this as a guy who's hung out around Washington a long time. Anything that's written into a bill to happen more than 5 years out is basically an offer to negotiate. It is a accounting gimmick, because what they have to do is come up with a score that will say within 10 years we'll reach a certain economic goal. Anyone here remember the SGR, the doc fix? Well, that was a proposal where they said, after 5 years, we're going to start reducing the payments 5% a year indefinitely. Okay, 5 years is a long time from now. We'll deal with that when we get there. The Affordable Care Act. It was paid for with $600 billion in savings, most of which came in year 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10. My point is that when you're dealing on a 10-year horizon and you're legislating on that 10-year horizon, what I'm telling you is I think we don't know yet, but I think in the next 5 years, what you can count on is about the same amount of money and more flexibility to deal with it. Now, you point out the fact that there's some problems, because The Republicans have 31 of the governorships, and some of them are in very large states that have expanded Medicaid population, and they're saying to the president, whoa, we got you elected. You're really going to take the money away? And then you've got the other Republican governors who are saying, we stood tall behind the repeal and replace pledge, and we did not expand Medicaid because we were believers. Now, you're going to take the money away from us, and we're not going to share in this? So the way they're solving that is they're not going to repeal it for those who did expand, and for those who didn't expand, they're going to find ways to put $6 or $8, $10 billion into what they'll call an opioid plan, or they'll put some other name on it, but it'll basically be money that will be enough that they can feel like they got their piece of this pie. That's the way that'll work. Now, this is not pretty, but it's kind of the way sausage is made in this environment. But the net is we still have this economic pressure. We still have this glacial force coming at us. We still have to respond to this. And the North Star, what's the North Star? The North Star is our ability to provide better care at lower costs. And if that is your North Star, I think we will, in fact, succeed. So, Dennis, okay, one more question.
One more question. Thank you, Governor. Drew Rector, Health First, Rockledge, Florida. So that's a perfect lead-in on the value. When does the other side of D.C., as far as Stark and antitrust, and some of the things that when you're talking to systems here that have a health plan and have a health system, and as we move towards that value and integration, that part of D.C. Doesn't seem to be in line with the value proposition that you and others are outlining.
So could I just say, I think on the whole value thing right now, we're in a bit of an idle. Because the administration still hasn't got it together in terms of their ability to actually execute on a lot of the regulatory things. And I believe there is a long list of things, like you've talked about, that are required for the federal government to change if they really want to get there. And I can't tell you when I think that'll happen, but I do think if they, as they commit themselves and feel this economic pressure, I keep saying this, but it's the economic pressure. Now, keep in mind, they raised interest rates yesterday for the second time this year. I want to say again, what happens if they get back to a normalized interest rate? And you might remember I suggested it would be $800 billion more per year in interest. We now have fiscal policy that is inching toward that point, and that can only do one thing. It puts more pressure on the Congress to begin to resolve the issues that stand in the way of this uniquely American system. I can't tell you which of those next 15 years that's going to happen, but I think it will. I have confidence not because of any politics or ideology. I just happen to believe economic imperatives are bigger than politics. And in time, politics will be overridden by economics, or we'll end up making a decision that I hope and don't believe we will make, to abandon our sense of compassion or to abandon our economic leadership. The unique American system is finding the way to solve the problem, and we have, I think, a pathway. And I'll again end with saying, I don't think it's going to be Congress that does that. It's going to be people like you who, for your comparative advantage to work, you've got to find ways to follow the North Star. Thank you.
Thank you.